extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, Matt Doyle. January 25th, Extra Time, Espectacular. Coming up, Diego Valeri joins us to talk Pedro de la Vega, the newest big name signing in Seattle. He's got his takes on 2024, Messi included, and much more from MLS's resident poet laureate. We got weekend transfers sponsored by one and only Tom Bogert, FC Dallas chasing a Benfica forward, Albert Elise to the Revs, and more headlines. Plus, our LAFC quietly cooking or quietly crumbling, and Dean Smith wraps his mind around the designated player rule in Charlotte. Much more to come in the mailbag. Some good stuff. Doyle, hello. How are you?
I am well. I am kind of enjoying the downtime because it feels like not even the off season has really heated up yet. I think we're all waiting for some big signings to come. You referenced LAFC. Man, look at that roster, Wiebe. Like, they have so many moves still to make. So I'm all tingly with anticipation for what's going to happen over the next month.
Hey, they traded for some international roster spots.
They did.
We've got some rumors coming through, which we'll walk you through. A big signing up from LAFC to a guy who calls himself Giorgio Chiellini's son. Like, figuratively, more than literally. But we'll get into that here in a second. Diego's coming up. What's the best thing you saw preseason edition, Doyle? Let's bring it back as we get ourselves hyped for the 2024 campaign.
Yeah, there wasn't a ton to recommend. The U.S. national team's friendly against Slovenia. They lost that one 1-0. But Diego Luna, who I absolutely love, got his first cap, and he started on the left wing, and he would pinch inside, and he played a couple of through balls that were just gorgeous, and that's what we all love from Diego Luna. But then Esmer Badrakhtarevic, the winger slash number 10 homegrown kid, I think he's still just 18 for the Revs, he came on for the last 20-25 minutes. Maybe he was freaking awesome, and I had not ever particularly rated him, and we're talking about an incredibly small sample size from the final 20-25 minutes of the Camp Cupcake friendly. So let's not...
But just enough.
Yeah.
Just enough.
Yeah, exactly. It is just enough. It was fun to watch social media sort of blow up with this kid's highlights. He put on a show, and you want it, like, in a situation like that with the Olympics coming up and he's Olympic eligible, you want to take your chance, and he took it. He made it fun to watch for the final 20 minutes of that one.
That sound you heard after he megged the guy with his first touch was everyone rushing to Google to figure out how to spell his name. A lot of Google corrects coming through on Esmer, but a one-name guy potentially. We'll see what happens with him. The Revs also in big news. My best thing I just happened onto from Massive Report, a Wilfred Nancy press conference in which he talked about Derek Jones for 5 minutes, Doyle. Oh. He's going over potential, how much he rates Derek Jones, this profile that we did not have, tall but agile, comfortable on the ball. What can he do in Columbus? He certainly sounds, Wilfred, like he sees Jones as a midfielder.
Yeah.
So that's interesting, adept play. But to hear Nancy talk about a guy he thinks he can get more out of, not potential, it is progression. I mean, it was a terrible French accent from me, but a wonderful experience to hear that from Wilfred Nancy. And imagine what he can do with Jones, with Hinostroza, and a bunch of other guys. The defending champs just seem to reload. But I'm actually going to give it to Brandon Vasquez, scoring his first Monterrey goal in a draw, unfortunately for Rayados. But a near post header, nobody's marking him on that near post run, but nice header straight into the ground underneath the goalkeeper. His celebration was iconic. Like, he knew where... Did you see the pictures that came out of this on social media?
I did not.
Brandon Vasquez knew where the photographer was. He knew where the cameras were. He got in the perfect position due to the arms crossed, like the pose.
Yeah.
He's going to go all around that fan base.
The pose and that jawline, man. Like, that jawline is always a star.
Combo.
Yeah.
Good combo. And the Rayados jerseys are classic as always. So congratulations to him. I was watching it and just thinking about Leagues Cup as one with my particular brand of obsession does. Cade Cowell, Chicharito now at Chivas. plenty more transfers happening. I mean, hell, Frank Bolli is in Liga MX. We're going to see Frank Bolli in League's Cup. I'm going to have to lock in a little bit on the Clausura just to make sure I'm ready. And we have help in that regard. Maria, producer Maria, her Liga MX corner is coming to every show where we can reasonably remember it, but Maria will help educate us. So big time moment for Vasquez.
Are we going to call it Liga MX corner? Or are we going to call it Pumas corner? Because we know it's going to have a certain tilt.
It depends on how well the season goes for Pumas. But if you have suggestions on what this should be called, what you want to hear about, let us know. So Brandon Vasquez scored, but it was the same match, I believe, that Monterrey said goodbye to Rogelio Funes Mori after 9 years. And Funes Mori's going to Pumas.
Mm-hmm.
Doyle, so there's our first Pumas mention of this particular Liga MX corner. So we'll see what happens with Funes Mori. Chicharito's back, of course. They've sold out his presentation at the stadium. Like, the entire stadium will be full just to see him presented, but we don't actually know when he's going to play. So TBD on that one. And Andres Guardado is back. Always thought he might end up in Chicago or, you know, in MLS somewhere. Not the case. He's going to be at León. So León gets a big-time Eltri and European
a legend. Andres Guardado has been, you know, one of the best central midfielders in CONCACAF history. And, you know, he's 36 now, so he's not in his prime anymore by any stretch. But that hasn't really mattered for León. Like, even when they won CONCACAF Champions League last year, I think that front line, the ages were like 34, 32, and 35 across their front line. So it kind of fits in with the MO of that club, which is just like they are filled with tried and tested pros who will just grind you down and wear you out and outlast you and get the win.
From the club that brought you signing Landon Donovan, here comes Andres Guardado to Club León. But look, man, League's Cup is going to be awesome. These two leagues just continued to be more intertwined. The more transfers that happen, the more competition that occurs between clubs all the way to the top, to the bottom, as opposed just to what we see in CONCACAF Champions Cup. It's going to be a fun year to kind of dip your toes in the water of Liga MX as we, of course, follow along very closely to Major League Soccer. And nobody is more fun to follow Major League Soccer with than Diego Valeri. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed, and I know you agree, Doyle, all last year sitting down in that windowless basement room mainlining MLS with Diego. So before Diego comes on, give people an idea of what it is like to watch hundreds, literally hundreds, of MLS games with this legend.
He watches games the way he played. Like, I don't know how to explain it. Like, he always played with such elegance, but like real incisiveness. And that was like, you know, we would watch the games together, everybody in that basement, and, you know, big play happens and it's like, oh, everybody's, you know, emoting and, you know, talking over each other. And then Diego comes with oh, but you see, blah, 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 you know, and he's experiencing the emotion too, but it almost like sadness for the lack of beauty that just happened, or just like real appreciation for how elegant this sequence of play was. Look, man, he's talented. He's multi-talented. He makes it fun in a way that I wasn't necessarily expecting. And I'm excited that we get to work with him a little bit more this year, having him as a regular on Extra Time.
All right, without further ado, the man, the myth, the legend. You can't see it right now. I know we're not on video. It's audio. But this guy's got an MLS MVP award sitting right over his right shoulder. Diego Valeri. ¿Cómo estás, Diego?
Andrew, how are you? Thank you for having me. I'm okay. I'm missing the football of MLS.
The offseason's too long for you as well. I feel nice and rested, but I'm ready to get back to it. We sort of have preseason trickling along. We'll ask you about Messi in just a second. But overall, we were just raving about watching games with you in our little basement room. But I'm still curious. First year of broadcasting, instead of playing, you're off the field, you're behind the microphone. What did you enjoy about it? What was it like for you?
Oof, that's a big question for me. In my first experience, I think it was you guys. It was the group of people we work with. As you said, it's been a long year. Very fun for me. It was funny and attractive to see how it's been around the game, but not inside the game. And yeah, it was about you because you make me feel so good. And you know, it's been sometimes heavy because we you know, we have been inside watching many games at the same time. But I like it. I really like it. And you made it easier for me. You helped me a lot. So yeah, it was a great experience. Of obviously after mid-year when with Messi's arrival and Leagues Cup was really fun. I really liked that. And I started to go more to call games and watch soccer at the stadiums. And I liked that part of the year too. So this first year of broadcasting, it was amazing. And it opened, you know, for me an adventure in my life that I didn't expect it.
When you watch a game, how do you watch it? Do you focus on the team shape? Do you focus on where the teams are drawing the lines of confrontation? What kind of passes they're hitting from the back? Like, do you have a sort of a checklist that you go through as you're watching a game to try to understand how it's playing out tactically? Or is it less sort of regimented than that?
Hey, Matt, that's a very good question. So I'm trying to be more open to watch more as a spectator, more as a supporter, as a watcher of the MLS, right? But it's difficult for me. So the first 20 minutes, what I do is trying to figure it out what the coaches want of the team, you know, what they want to do, right? In the first 20 minutes where you really can see how they prepare for that game. You know, what they want to do. So obviously, with that said, you see if they build up, if they don't, how they break lines, how they move, how they organize when they lose the ball, right? And obviously, you know, the connections. I like to see the connections, the partners, right? That we say the little societies that start to show up in the game. Right. And because that can change sometimes, can break games at the beginning of the game. But at the same time, being, you know, all the time watching so many games, I try to enjoy it a little bit. I try to be more in the simple stuff. I don't want to be so tactic mindset to watch a game and enjoy, because I want to in this new role, I want to transfer to that simple stuff, right? The stuff that most of the people wants to watch. This is a game that creates so many emotions, right? So I want to transfer that instead of being so cold and focus on the tactic side, right? But yes, at the beginning of the game, I try to see what the coaches prepare, what they want to do, what the team is wanting to do, how they want to win the game. I'm very focused on that, on how they want to win the game, because I believe that that's the most important in professional soccer. Obviously, the most important is winning, but this, right, you know,
the process,
on their side, the process, yeah, on how to do it is for me really attractive. So the first 20, 25 minutes, and then I follow the actions, right? I try to be action by action, trying to see if you know, if something changed, because there's a flow in the game. There's a flow in the game. I actually was really kind of like that when I was a player, because the flow of the game is really important. You know, how the game flows, how the game goes, and you should. I think there's something that I really like to do, but after the 30th minute, right? Before that, I watch. And I focus on what the team is trying to do in different phases of the game.
A new situation for you in your life, Diego. It has been so much fun to be around you. Pedro de la Vega is coming from a place that you know well, to the Seattle Sounders, from Lanús all the way to the Pacific Northwest. Sounders fans are excited about this one. A guy who's going to wear the number 10, play on that left wing, come inside, be creative on the ball, a big-time prospect at Argentina, at the club that is close to your heart. How excited are you for Pedro, and what are the Sounders getting with Pedro de la Vega?
I am so, so excited and happy to have Pedro in our league. Obviously, you know, it's Seattle, it's okay, but you know, I'd rather, you know, I think they decided really well. I think they get a great, you know, signing with Pedro. I know him really well. I was actually talking to him many times before this deal was done, and he looked so excited to come to the league and to show in Seattle. And actually, when I was in Lanús talking to him, he looked very attractive about the MLS and how that, you know, how the league was a good fit for him. And I think he can play on the left winger, or he can, you know, join them in different places of the field, which is, you know, is very flexible, because he's not a true winger. You know, he can play as a second striker. He's not a 10, right? But he can play as a, I can see him playing, you know, with Morris on top or even on the right, or, you know, sometimes if they play five in the back and three in the middle, he can join as a interior midfielder, like an attacking midfielder, right? So he's a great player. I think they got it right, because it's not going to be easy to replace Nicolás Lodeiro, right? Because, you know, what he represents for the team. So I think this is a great choice to do it. And as I said, I'm so happy. I know him really well. His mindset is really competitive. So I don't know. It's probably, you know, I want to see him right away, how he adapts, because he's, you know, he's one of the best players in the Argentinian leagues. He was,
In terms of his skill set, the name that comes to mind, and I haven't watched a ton of Lanús, maybe like two games last year, but then you watch a lot of clips and everything. He reminds me a little bit of Ignacio Piatti, who, of course, had a great career in MLS with Montreal. His ability to eliminate players 1v1, and to bring it to what you were talking about before, when you watch a game, you try to figure out what the manager wants to do. And I think we all saw the same thing with the Sounders last year, was they wanted to control both the rhythm of the game and where on the field it was played. And the way they did that was, and kind of worked at it, ended up working against Nicolás Lodeiro, was they had a very structured three-man midfield, and they would be able to control the game through that. And then that put the onus on the wingers to make the sort of game-breaking plays. And we saw, especially in the playoffs against LAFC, time and time again, they would be able to arrange the game to get the ball onto Leo Chu's foot on the left wing in a 1v1 situation. And time and again, Leo Chu wasn't able to eliminate, I think it was mostly Ryan Hollingshead, in that sit. And it seems to me that the reason they sort of zeroed in on Pedro was because, like, he has that exact skill set. He has that ability. If you get him on the ball 1v1, either out on the touchline or more often sort of inside a little bit with a left back coming around him, he has the ability to eliminate the fullback 1v1.
Yeah, no, 100%. I totally agree with everything. It actually is it's not the same exact that Ignacio, but it's a good comparison. It's he can dribble, he can take 1v1 guys, but at the same time, I would say that he has a good long distance shot. I mean, he can kick from distance, which is good, right? He can join even the box, right? It's good on the earth, so it's good for headers. So he has many. Different resources, technical resources, right? And he actually can manage the set pieces. Obviously, they have good feet on Rusnak, on different guys that can manage the set pieces, but he can join them too. So I think I totally agree with you. Seattle needed that. It showed that last year that they many games they were not able to take advantage of those when they put the ball in those positions. So Pedro I think Pedro has a little bit of everything to make it happen, right? And obviously he's gonna need a time to adapt, right? Probably now he's showing them in the preseason, and it's gonna be good for them to play friendlies and figure it out, you know, how to connect with teams. But I agree with you, Seattle needed that, and he is a guy that knows how to take advantage, right? And obviously in his back he has many technical resources.
Yeah.
So does Thiago Almada. Pedro de la Vega's got to prove himself. Much more on this, by the way, with our friends at Nos Arietes with Jeremiah Ocean, Sandra at Hart. They're covering this one in depth. And I believe Diego's on a podcast with them, so I'm sure they'll get more. I want to ask you about Almada, though, Diego. How should this transfer? I don't know if we're at a saga point yet. I don't think it's a saga. But how will this transfer pan out, in your opinion? When does Thiago Almada get sold? Where will he go? What's the right move for player and for club?
Oof, that's a difficult question to answer.
$25 million question for you there, Diego.
Yes, I know. So, I don't know. It depends, Andrew. It depends. I don't know. It depends. The club, it depends the project that the club has on him. It depends what he wants. I think he still has more to do in MLS, more to do for Atlanta. I think he showed he grew up a lot, right? He took leadership. He took a place in the team. And I think he is becoming more and more important every year. So I don't know. But if you ask me, not always it's about what the player wants. Obviously, I don't know Atlanta what want to do. So it depends. It depends. So if you ask me, I would say that for now the best is to stay, right? Is to stay in Atlanta, not to move. But you know, there's many stuff around it. I don't know what to think.
Who's your favorite player to watch in MLS right now, Diego? Who's the guy?
No, that's easy. You know that's easy to answer. So
Jacob Schaffelberg.
You want me to answer?
Okay. Jacob Schaffelberg. Yeah. No shade to Jake. We love Jacob Schaffelberg. It's just a joke.
We're laughing. It's true. No, it's Messi. It's Messi. Of course, it's Lionel Messi.
All right, let's talk about Messi in Miami. Diego, Luis Suarez is saying, four trophies, dream big. Why not? Why can't we win them all? And why can't they, to be honest? Looking at that squad, looking at the legends, what are the right expectations for Inter Miami as a collective and Lionel Messi as an individual?
I mean, Suarez talk, it makes sense, right? Because they have, you know, signed so many players that have won it all. And every beginning of the season, they just think about winning every single tournament that they play. So it makes sense. I don't know if that's going to be easy. Impossible is nothing in soccer, but it's not going to be easy because of the amount of games, the amount of traveling, and you know, MLS is so even. So, but obviously you always prepare for that. I think they
How many trophies? How many trophies you think they get?
Oh, I don't know. Hey, you know, that answer is so difficult in Major League Soccer and in That's all true. Those competitions, but
will you guarantee to us, Diego Valera, will you guarantee that they'll win one?
One, at least one.
Okay, at least one.
At least one.
At least one.
One.
Okay. One of the things that we've seen from them throughout these two early preseason games, and it's just preseason, so you don't want to read too much into it, but they're not getting anybody in behind. And one of the things that you have to do, if Messi's the greatest passer of the ball any of us have ever seen, and one of the things you have to do to maximize his value, especially at this age where he's not as fast as he used to be, and he used to run in behind a little bit, he doesn't do that anymore, you have to be able to get runners in behind. And it looks like Tata's already kind of making some adjustments to maybe his preferred for like. He started the first game with Julian Gressel at right wing back. Second game, it was DeAndre Yedlin at right wing back because DeAndre has the kind of pace that you need in order to maximize what we're going to get from Messi, don't you think?
I agree. I agree with you. And let me tell you this, Matt. Running him behind, it's It's good for every single team. I mean, not and for every single player that has the ball on the feet. So because that creates, movement, creates spaces, right? It creates defense. They're organized, and with those running scene behind, it's key for having options, right? And for a team that really wants to attack, right? But at the same time, I think they're still, trying to see what's best. Obviously, Martino and with all the coaching stuff, analyzing what's best for Messi when he has the ball. But I think they are using, as you say, a lot of thinking the game about running scene behind, not about the strikers, but about the wingbacks or the, Jordi Alba making runs. I remember a great pass, Messi, he loves that, showing him from the left,
right
from the right to the center, and then having his left, and the running starts from there. And you can see many, many actions like that. We saw that last season, and we see, a lot in this couple of games with Jordi making that run. And obviously, Julian and Jedlin can be really helpful for it. I don't think they're gonna use the strikers for it. I think they're gonna use the outside backs, right? The people that is on the flanks, and it's smart because flanks are really hard to defend. And if the action moves, if the ball moves in the right speed, right? That run is from the flanks are really difficult to mark. Really difficult, really difficult. So I think they're still, knowing each other, knowing, I'm talking about everybody, players and coaching staff, right? And see, and trying to see what's, the best to take advantage. But I totally agree with you. At the same time, I would say that, of course, they're not, players Suarez or even Messi, right, that are gonna do that in a volume that you can tell they're gonna do it every single time. But they're smart enough to do it in the right moment, right? And you can tell that they're really smart to do it. So I think there's something that they're gonna improve, as they play more games.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Diego. We're talking about these friendlies in Miami are racking up the airline miles all around the world. I believe in Saudi Arabia or on the way to Saudi Arabia for a friendly against Al Nassr and another team as well. But Cristiano Ronaldo and Al Nassr are the one, as everybody's talking about here. Monday, January 29th. You can watch an MLS season pass at 1 p.m. Eastern. This preseason journey, put me in your player shoes. How difficult is this? The amount of travel, the amount of attention. Is there a toll that this is going to take on a team that already is, I'm not going to say old, but they're not young men anymore, a lot of them.
No, but they're used to, they're used to with the national teams games. They throughout the season, on their whole career, they have been like in a busy schedule all the time. I don't think it's that smart, adding miles in the preseason, but at the same time, it's motivated normal. And it's a good time for the team, right, to be united and to create moments, right, where they engage, when they united, when they are really focused about the game and about how to improve as a team, right. I can see, moments eating dinner or lunch, whatever, right? Breakfast and talking about the team, about the games, and obviously playing games is the most important in the preseason. So yeah, of course, in one side, it's not the best because you add so many miles, but in the other side of the coin, you have many friendlies to play. Important, attractive. It's motivated to see Ronaldo and Messi playing a game again. So it's been a while, right? And then at the same time, if you work well after the game in how to improve and what to improve, that's the most important. And then you create that cohesiveness in terms of team.
We must say, Facundo Farias injured in this run here. He will be out for the season. So that's a huge blow for Miami. We'll see how they deal with that one. Before we let you get off this topic, you have been a teammate of Lionel Messi before. Before Lionel Messi was Lionel Messi. Take us back to that U20 Argentina training session before the 05 U20 World Cup, where Lionel Messi sauntered in and changed perhaps the way all of you talented players yourself saw the game and how it could be played.
Yeah, so I had the chance to train and to be with him a couple of times, but I always remember that first time when he arrived to the Alpha facility. We were playing a rondo in the U20 camp before the World Cup, and he showed up there with that, you know, big clothing on him, and calm looking, you know, to the floor, and so humble, and nobody knew a lot about him, and you know, he's showing so silent the rondo, and he started to touch the ball with that extraordinary left foot, and then we play a small side, and nobody can steal the ball to him. He started dribbling guys like nothing, and changing the pace, as you know, in an unbelievable way, and all were so impressed and amazed about that contradiction of, you know, outside the field being so quiet, so calm, so humble, and then inside the field being a king, being a guy that, you know, so competitive and so wild. So, and obviously he showed that personality. He held that personality always in the whole career, and that's, it's a big thing, and I think that's why, you know, he maintained so many years being the best, you know, because he knows what he wants to do and he, how he is, and he value that, right? And that, you know, super competitive mindset, he still has that. So it's
but let it be known, Diego, he might be the GOAT. He might live in all of our imaginations, but you show up one time and your first impression is baggy clothes. And everybody is going to remember that forever. I love the way that starts. He shows a baggy clothes, very big clothes, very big clothes. Needed to figure out how to get a good fit. We'll talk more about Miami with you. And of course, we'll look forward to many, many hours, I'm sure, of breaking this down over the course of the season. Let's go outside Messi and Miami. What's the biggest preseason storyline, the biggest MLS storyline that you're paying attention to right now?
Oof. It's not easy to get only one, Andrew, because, you know, I'm very focused on Portland and the changes they've made. I like that. You know,
we can talk Portland.
Yeah.
Merritt Paulson says the next two signings, they have two DP spots open, will be the biggest this club has ever seen. We aren't filling the blanking around.
We are all excited about that. I know, you know, after two seasons not making the playoff, it's obviously that Portland is going to, you know, sign and invest in the team. And I think they did a good job getting Crepeau and Kamal. I think both are really good additions. So excited about what's going to happen. Obviously, across the river, they have signed, Seattle has signed Pedro de la Vega, which is a friend of mine. And I think that's, for me, huge. And at the same time, right, Nicolas Lodeiro going to Orlando, it's a good one for me because of the relationship I have with them, right? I think that's something that I've been focused during this transfer market.
All right. We're going to let you go, Diego. You have a long preseason, a lot of prep to do, many games to watch. We look forward to watching some with you this year. Thank you for stopping by, man.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Andrew and Matt. I'm so happy to be part of the team again.
Big thanks to Diego, one of those guys that does many things at a very high level. Playing soccer, talking soccer, and then just being a wonderful human being as well. Let's keep this show moving, Doyle. It's on to the transfer segment, sponsored by Tommy Scoops, a.k.a. the Doctor of Vibes, a.k.a. Mello's dad, a.k.a. Tommy DeVito's biggest fan, a.k.a. YouTube's favorite mustache, a.k.a. Tom Bogert. Thank you for supporting the show, Tom. Not with any sort of financial benefactory to us, but just with your vibes. We start with Hunter Brookbauer, who wanted us to revisit the Pedro de la Vega stuff and says, in that same discussion, would you guys have taken the offer for Leo Chu, even if it meant not making any money on the deal if you're the Sounders? The report was that there's a $4 million offer out of Brazil for Leo Chu. Was it Fluminense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was Fluminense.
Yep.
If you're not making money on it, then why would you take it? Right, Leo Chu is still a valuable player to have. I don't think he's a starter for a title caliber team, at least not on the wing. I still think there's some like unexplored upside with him as a wing back in a 3-5-2. But the Sounders are like, they intend to play 50-55 games this year. They intend to win the Supporter Shield, win Leagues Cup, win MLS Cup, maybe CONCACAF Champions League, maybe Open Cup as well. They need depth. They need good players. Leo Chu is still a good player. Don't sell him if you're not going to make a profit off of him. Now, if Fluminense comes back and offers $5 million instead, I think that's at the point where they would get full GAM repay on the sale, as well as a couple of bucks to make it profitable, then yeah, you probably take that. But they have to hit the number. Like, the way MLS works is, like, none of these teams are there's zero MLS teams that need to sell to survive, right? And that's what's different about this league than virtually any other league in the world outside of, like, the Premier League. Zero teams need to do that. So you can say, no, we're going to hold on to him until you actually hit the number. And Fluminense have the resources to do it. Why sell?
That sobbing you hear in the background right now is Anders and all Sounders fans in unison, knowing that there won't be in the CONCACAF Champions Cup this year. Indeed, they are not a Champions
League. That's right. Team. I totally forgot. I thought they would
like to get back to those heights. It would be wonderful if they were. Now, the New England Revolution are, and Albert Elise may be a member of the New England Revolution very shortly, Doyle. Seth McComber over the Blazing Musket reported on this, and Tom Bogert has since confirmed that initial report from Seth that the deal is close between Elise and the New England Revolution. Bogert saying the fee would be like $1.5 million and Elise would be a TAM player, not a DP, if they can get him. How would Elise change this team? Mike Marshall says, if New England signs Elise, how do you see the front four lining up? And then Tim is jumping further. If they get Elise, would it vault them from potentially top five in the East to true MLS contender status? How big would this be?
It depends upon the version of Albert Elise they're getting, right? Like, he, 5 years ago, 4 years ago in MLS, he was one of the best attackers in the entire league. He was absolutely fantastic. And when he first went to France, he kept playing at that level. Like, there was a time where it looked like he was going to play his way into, well, I mean, Bordeaux is traditionally one of the biggest clubs in France, even though they haven't been recently, but like, play his way sort of up the ladder. I think he had 9 goals in 20 games and it, 1,500 minutes in his first season. But over the past couple, Bordeaux dropped down to Ligue 2. He only had 1 goal last year. I think he's got 5 goals this year and round 1,000 minutes, but it's not even like he's a full-time starter. It has been a weird career trajectory for Albert Elise, and it's kind of been reflected in his play with Honduras as well. I don't think he's been as good with Honduras over the past couple of years. Maybe a return back to MLS is what he needs to be the player he was. If he is that version, then he's one of the four best wingers in the league, balancing Chanclay on one side and with Barrero potentially working his way back a little more slowly, a little less urgently from that ACL tear. It'll work. He'll be great. I'm not sure anything other than Giacomo Vrioni being a 15-goal scorer moves the Revs to that absolute elite tier in MLS. They would be knocking on the door with the all-star version of Albert Elise. They don't open that door unless Vrioni starts playing like a DP number 9.
I think it's unreasonable to expect Albert Elise to come back and be all-star status.
Why? He's in his prime. He's been an all-star before. So he just spent 3 years with Lee,
Let me dissect the word a little bit. Expect. Is it possible? Certainly. Certainly it is possible. But based on sort of the momentum of his career, I don't know that you want to expect it. If I was the Revs, based on the price point, $1.5 million, the fact that he's going to be down on that TAM spot, all these things about his last few years. You're looking for a guy who can be a high-level starter if he needs to start, and then give you options because Barrero's coming back, because Vrioni might not work out, and Elise could be more of a, you know, stretch the line, channel running number nine, more of a transition player than Giacomo Vrioni is. There's just a lot of ways that he can work within their setup. But to say like all-star off the jump, like, man, I imagine it. I want it. Pantarita, you know how much I enjoy the celebration, the persona, everything he was in Houston. It just feels like that's been a long time ago. So to expect him to be at that level maybe feels like expecting a tad too much. But we'll see. What do we expect from LAFC? Are they crumbling, as I said in the intro, or are they cooking? Doyle, out. Philip Krastev, on loan last summer. The Bulgaria international, nope. There was a $7 million option. Obviously, they weren't going to trigger that. So the 22-year-old has got to find somewhere else to go. Back in Europe, Stipe Biuk came in with a big price tag. $6 million, a big-time prospect, just 21. Well, it looks like, according to Tom, he's headed to Real Valladolid. So he's out. Mario Gonzalez is out. There are credible rumors that Omar Campos from Santos Laguna is coming in to play left back. He would be a U22 signing, but that would eliminate their flexibility on U22s because loaning Biuk does not get him off the books, and you still have Bogus. Then you have two open DP spots, and you have Buanga, who is, depending on who you believe on any given day, disgruntled about his contract and may or may not want to be there. Are they cooking? Because they got international spots and there's no leaks. Or is this more on the crumble side?
It doesn't look great right now, right? Like, if you look at this roster, I think we said it on the last show, other than Toronto and Austin, this is the most incomplete roster in the league, and it's getting less complete by the day. And the other concern about this, Weeby, we talked about it a lot in 2022. What John Thorington did in the winter transfer window between the seasons of 21 and 22 is what turned LAFC into a juggernaut. And what he did in that window was go out and get guys like Maxime Crépeau and Ryan Hollingshead and Kellen Acosta and Ilya Sanchez, guys who had a ton of experience in MLS and who had won in MLS before. And if you look back at that season, everybody remembers the summer window because that's when they brought in Gareth Bale and they, you know, brought in Chiellini and, you know, Christian Teo, all these big name Europeans. They actually played worse in the second half of 2022 than they did in the first half of 2022. When they built from within, when they went out and identified and acquired the best MLS free agents, they haven't done that since. And that has been a sort of a slow dismantling of the team. And the guys they brought in last year are guys who you just listed off as now outgoing. And they don't have the same kind of depth and flexibility that they had in 22 and 23 when they, you know, made five finals and won at least one of them. It's weird. It reminds me a little bit, starting to remind me a little bit of the slow dismantling of that great Atlanta United team of 2018 and 2019 when they sort of undervalued the experienced guys that they had on hand and overvalued expensive imports who sort of uniformly underperformed. God, if not for Buanga, would you be able to point to a single acquisition they made over the past three windows and say that guy was a home run?
Tim Tillman might be that guy.
I mean, Tillman was good. He wasn't a 90-minute player.
Yeah, Christian Oliveira, you could see maybe becoming that guy.
Right.
But man, Mario Gonzalez was just sort of such a face-flat like signing that worked in zero possible ways. I mean, that is a gut punch. For them to go get him in the summer, to go win a championship, to not win that championship, and then to loan him out however many months later. Now, the flip side of this, and why I say cooking or crumbling, is like, there are no leaks coming out. They just went and got international spots. Mm-hmm. Omar Campos is a really, really good young player. And that would be a great replacement for Chiqui Palacios at left back. But like ultimately, I think it comes down to, one, the depth and experience, but also the top-end spots. Carlos Vela, we don't know if he's coming back. It's right. Like Buanga and what? That you can hang your hat on, guarantee they're going to play at a super high level. Ryan Hollingshead is one of those guys. He's maybe he's in one of your center backs. Yeah, maybe one of your center backs, depending, can be one of those guys, Mario Arlong, or I don't know, Eddie Segura in honor of David Goss, Hugo Lloris. I mean, it's just the list of difference makers is not that long, but when I don't hear leaks and I know John Thorington can sign players that we don't think other teams can sign or that LAFC could sign and he goes and does it, I get a little bit cautious for LAFC, but the clock is ticking for him. It's ticking big time right now. One of the feel-good stories, though, is center back depth. MLS Aces hit us up and said, hey, make sure to talk about Lorenzo De La Valle. He's the LAFC 2 guy, the kid from Juventus who captained or played on that Italy team that won the Youth Euros. He got a first-team deal. He calls Giorgio Chiellini his father figure, and Chiellini is sticking around for 6 months. So congratulations to Lorenzo. He might turn into a player here, and what an experience he's having with Chiellini and living in LA at a tender young age right now. How about Dean Smith's first week in Charlotte, Doyle? Did he know about the DP rule before? I guess he figured it out quick because he said Kamil Jozwiak is out of here.
Yeah.
I was like, this guy ain't it. Whatever a DP is, he is not it.
No. And that was a long time coming. Jozwiak was obviously never going to be DP caliber in this league, and then backed that up with his play for the past 2 years. The interesting thing to me is we thought that they were going to be able to get Grunbach, the guy from Bodø/Glimt, and they're not budging on that number. They want, I think it was 12 million that Tom reported.
In fact, I think they re-signed Grunbach to a new contract with a larger release fee, if I remember correctly. And that sounds like Grunbach's agent did a very good job in this situation to get what he wanted for his player.
Yeah. So the way Dean Smith has sort of shaped it is like, okay, everybody who is here is not someone that, like, nobody here is someone that I've signed. So you have to prove yourself to me. And it's, I think, what you want to hear if you're a fan. Now, how guys like Kamil Jozwiak and Enzo Capetti, and even the veterans like Scott Arfield and Westwood, guys who were pretty decent last year, maybe they don't like hearing it, but we'll see. It's starting to feel, though, more and more like this is going to end up being a complete teardown and rebuild.
Here's what Dean Smith had to say about his two designated players that are still around, and Enzo Capetti and Karol Swiderski. Quote, both are goal scorers, but I think their return has to be better than it was last season, and that's the pressure I will put on them. But the beauty of it for me is that they're not DPs that I chose, so they have to prove to me that they're valuable to me and the team. He says he's seen their willingness to do that, but man, I had to reread that part about the beauty of it is that they're not DPs that I chose. Basically, I owe you nothing. Like, you better come in and get it done. And for a team that has, I think, languished below their own expectations, certainly, and sort of crumbled in big moments, to your point, that's probably what they need to hear. How about FC Dallas? Apparently in talks with Benfica over a potential sign for Croatian international striker Petar Musa, who scored a good amount of goals but looks to be on his way for maybe $7 million. Would this be the signing that FC Dallas needs? He's just 25 years old, 17 goals, 5 assists, and less than 2,000 minutes across 64 appearances in 8 months with Benfica. So not a first-choice guy, but a guy who produces when he's there, and he's played for Boavista, Slavia Prague, and Union Berlin.
And the Croatian national team. He checks a lot of boxes. He seems like a guy that most MLS teams should be interested in. This would be a great signing for FC Dallas, whether or not they keep Jesus Ferreira. And we know that there have been some reports on that. We're not going to touch them because we don't know all the moving pieces that have happened in it. But my long-standing argument is that Jesus Ferreira is better as a sort of a 9.5, a second forward in any, like, a 4-4-2 or a 3-5-2. Getting him to play off of Petar Musa, I love that, especially for a team that lost their number 10 for the season, right? I think it's a very easy way for them to generate consistent attack. The other thing about it is, like, maybe you could play Musa and Bernie Camungo up top together and then drop Jesus Ferreira in the hole as a playmaker in a 3-5-2. All of that is on the table for Dallas in terms of formation and tactical flexibility if they get this signing done. I hope they do. I think it makes them a much more interesting and much more dangerous team.
Dan Hunt seems to be sending out some hints, and obviously they're having to deal with Velasco being hurt long term. But FC Dallas trying to build a little bit, see what they can do with that one. LA Galaxy, more negotiations, TBD on the winger in Belgium. But Dynamo Zagreb has a highly rated, again, Croatian youth international winger that the Galaxy are after with a U22 spot. We'll see if they can get that one done. It would fill out their U22 spots. Dan Jovlich and Julian Aude are the other two. Into $2 to $4 million signing news, Doyle, because that's how we're organizing the show now, because MLS teams just keep checking the box. Cincinnati apparently signing a Czech midfielder from Victoria Pilsen, 25-year-old Pavel Busha. He's a prime age, box-to-box guy, would seem to be a replacement in there for Moreno. So we'll see if that one goes down. You'd think that would be in that little $2 to $4 million bucks. Ludogorets have reportedly agreed to sell their midfielder in Bulgaria international, Dominik Yankov, to Montreal for $2 million. Here we go. Yankov was born in Toronto, so he'd be returning to Canada. And Matias Cocaro from Huracan. A forward, Uruguayan forward from Argentina, reportedly going to Montreal as well. NYCFC, let's hit them real quick. Couple rumors. It's been quiet, but Matias Arezzo, who we've heard about before, who has been on loan at Peñarol and scored, I think, 18 goals in his most recent period there after going to Granada and La Liga and not really playing. And Agustin Ojeda out of Racing, a very, very young prospect in Argentina, both linked, as well as a Serbian forward from Red Star that City Football Group is going to purchase. And then Tyus Magno could be sold for X number of million to Bologna. What's going on with NYCFC? It feels like it's like a stash house for young prospects right now.
Yeah, which is, I think, an appropriate role for this team to play in terms of viewing it from City Football Group's point of view. The good thing about it, though, is last year they did this without having the spine of the team built up. Well, this year they have James Sands from the start. They have their starting center backs, Berkarisa and Thiago Martins, from the start. I think they've probably settled on Matt Fries as the starting goalkeeper. He was good down the stretch for them. They have Santi Rodriguez from the start. They have Munsaf Bakrar, who we're still not 100% sure is a starting caliber center forward, but we know that he's good enough to soak up some minutes, and he makes the entire attack function, I think, at a higher level, function more smoothly. So this is all in place for NYCFC, which allows them, I think, to go out and be a little speculative on some of these young signings and integrate them more slowly into the first team over the course of the season. They tried to do this last year while still piecing together the foundation. I like it. I like that they have a different point of view on how to build a team. And I think that even under, you know, Dome Tarrant and then Ronnie Dyla and obviously Patrick Vieira before that, they were kind of doing the same thing, though, to a lesser degree. They won a lot doing it. They won a lot of games. They only won one trophy, but still, they won a lot. They played a lot of good soccer. I don't see why they couldn't continue to do so under Nick Cushing, provided that they are able to keep Keaton Parks and James Sands and Santi Rodriguez and their center backs on the field and in the rotation 90 minutes week after week after week.
Yeah, Keaton's had some issues with injury, but he's just signed a long-term contract extension. Looks like James Sands is there, as well as Rodriguez, for the long term. And it makes you think back on those years with Maxi and with Sean Johnson and, you know, Kyan's in the back, as well as Chanot, and this group that you knew you could build around. You know, Tati is able to come in and be a young player that needs time and development, but then flourish. Like, they need that out of some of these young guys. Julian Fernandez is another on the right wing. Johannes Wolf, the signing out of the Bundesliga. I mean, it's interesting. You just wonder if those guys will be ready or if there's a Gas Theorem element to it as well. And if they can sell Tyus Magno for the amount that people are saying right now, more than $10 million, you probably got to get that done, because last year was pretty disappointed for him. Sam Vines, back to the Rapids. Chris Werenberg says, is he instantly a top five left back in the league? What do you think? In the convo.
Yeah, he's instantly in the convo, right? I'm not sure he is instantly going to go on the list as
to crown him.
Yeah, but like, yeah, he could be in that conversation. I think one and two are still Wagner and then Alvaro Barrial. I know left wing back isn't left back, but they fulfill the same role. And oh yeah, that guy down in Miami, Jordi Alba, is still really good as well. So like,
DeJuan Jones, put him in there. Yeah, as he returns from injury, just signed an extension himself, by the way.
So you could see it's. I mean, John Tolkien is still around. So you can see it's the kid.
It's crowded.
Yeah, it's crowded.
Left back is stronger than it used to be. Used to be we'd talk about this and right back had all these names that you'd run through. Now it's left back. By the way, error on my part. Brandon Bye coming back from injury. DeJuan Jones. All good. Into the mailbag. David and Skokie, the legend. Welcome back to the new year, guys. Two questions. One, do you know when the League's Cup schedule is being announced? My family's making summer vacation plans, and I'd like to see the game in a new city if possible. Sorry about that, David. I don't know it. I'm sure it will come out, but I love that you are literally planning your year around League's Cup. You're the man. Two, what hope is there for the Chicago Fire? I've been a fan since season one and have perhaps foolishly raised my boys to be Fire fans as well. My youngest is 9. The Fire have made the playoffs once in his lifetime. My oldest is 13 and he's never seen the Fire win even a single playoff game. Is there any reason to suspect either of those streaks might change this year?
No.
Oh, God. Yeah, I'm keeping the Malort on the shelf. So, yeah, we need some more transfer news around them. Doesn't seem like Kellen Acosta is in a big hurry if that's who they're targeting right now.
Right, and he would be a nice fit. We've talked about that. The Fire, they were down near the bottom of the league in chance creation last year. And I know that the Fire fans really want a new number 9. Well, you know, they got Kasper Schabilko. He scored 15 goals the year before he came to the Fire. He has scored 9 goals
a word about Tom Barlow. Don't even.
They got Kai Kamara.
Come in these streets.
They got Kai Kamara, who I think had 10 goals in 2022 for Montreal. And he comes to Chicago. He scored, 5 last year in the same.
And all in the first half.
In the same amount of minutes. The Fire were, I think, 27th in the league in expected assists. They were down near the bottom in expected value from their possession, which is not where you want to be. Jordan Shaqiri has not been a number 10. I like Brian Gutierrez a lot. I'm not sure I like him run your entire attack through him levels. That's probably a little bit too much to ask for him. I think he's more of a secondary creator. This is a roster that has not been good enough for years and years. I do think they upgraded left back. Andrew Gutman will help in terms of chance creation. If Salkvist, the big Danish defender they got, if he's as good as they hope, then that will allow Gutman to go upfield and attack, I won't say at will, but be more of an attacker than a defender, and that's probably what they need. But this is still a team whose DPs have been among the very worst in the league for a good long while. And oh yeah, Jairo Torres is still around. We thought he would be gone by now, and he's been maybe the biggest DP bust in history. If you look at what he's done over the past 2 years.
Yeah, no, I think based on the price point and the expectations and the lack of production. Yeah, okay, well, let's on a brighter note, Austin fans hit us up, said Josh Wolf said in a press conference that the club has no plans of purchasing a new striker. This is the fan here also having his say. Ragone was played in the 9, which worked decent, and should Sebastian Pinot be a first-team player? Wolf stated that Pinot did okay in the first preseason game against the Union. I had to go look up who that was. He's a former Peru and Chile youth international who has, his professional career has not really launched. I think he's 21 years old. Like, he's not yet a known commodity in the professional sense. That is... Whew, that does not fill you with the flashing green lights are not going for me right now, Doyle.
I mean, I'm going to peel back the curtain a little bit and let our Austin fans know that Weeby thought that this was so grim, he did not want to even include it in the show.
Just the suggestion that Ragone played at the 9, which worked out decent, and then Josh Wolf saying this very young, very unproven, essentially MLS Next Pro player at this point, so quote, did okay in the first preseason. I mean, that is tough.
That is tough. Here's the reasoning behind Ragone at the 9 maybe being decent. Sebastian Giriussi is a number 10, but not an orchestrator from midfield number 10. He's more of an Italian number 10 in that he wants to be in and around the box. And specifically what made him so great in 2022 was his one touch finishing off of box movement. What happened in 2023 was they got a number 9 in Jossie Zardes, who also specializes in one touch finishing off of box movement. They had zero chemistry. So the idea would be, in Ragone as a number 9, you get a guy who plays as a false 9, who actually drops in and playmakes a little bit. And that then allows Driussi to pick and choose his spots for getting forward, more similar to what he was able to do in 2022 with Maxi Arruti, who's also not a real number 9. He's more of a false 9 in terms of his final third movement. And allow the number 10 to cook as a goal scorer. The problem with Ragone in that role is he doesn't defend. And Arruti was one of the best defensive number 9s in MLS for, you know, 5-6 years. And if you don't get that kind of defense from your number 9, you make it really, really easy to build into the heart of your midfield. And so we actually saw that happen to Austin a lot in 2023, and they were so wide open, they would just get shredded. So I think I'm not going to say it solves one problem playing Ragone as a number 9. I will say theoretically, it is a better stylistic fit with Driussi, but it opens up a whole new level of problems defensively for a team that has in Owen Wolf and Danny Pereira, two good young players, neither of whom is a real midfield ball winner. I just think it's a broken roster. I don't think
that
it works.
All that you just went through, the question I'm sitting here thinking is like, it doesn't answer any question other than where do you play or problem other than where do you play Ragone?
Yeah.
There's you no don't. Other. It's you, just, don't. You just have to, because he's on the roster and he's a DP. Maybe it'll be better, man. You never know. You never know. We were high on Austin before last year, and that fell apart quickly, too. That's MLS for you. How about Benny in the Bay Area? Guys, thought, aren't the Quakes the Kellen Acosta team? Immediately he starts every game, and the Quakes get a marketable USMNT guy to replace Cade on a potentially reasonable contract. He then allows Chikaris and Medina to step into a full-time role in a more of an attacking role with some defensive help. And Cook, what do we think? Kellen to San Jose, just as a thought experiment.
I mean, if it was Grueso and Kellen together deep in a 4-2-3-1, we know for a fact that works, because we saw that for a couple years in Dallas before Grueso was sold. I'm not sure that. So Nico Sakiris, 18-year-old homegrown central midfielder, he's more of an 8.5. than he is a pure number 10. Cruz Medina, super talented, still 16, right? Like, he's probably not ready yet. And he really struggled throughout 2023. Kellen would fit. I just think that he maybe fits better in a couple other places.
He'd fit, but he masks the real need. The real need is like a true number 10 that can be a chance creator. I mean, right now you're looking at basically the entire chance creation responsibility sitting on Christian Espinoza's shoulders, and he's shown those are, you know, he can rise to that level. He can do it. But then it's Espinoza, it's Obobese, and it's Benji Kaganovic, and then it's no other proven attacker on the entire roster.
Yeah, and we're using the word proven really loosely when referring to Benji Kaganovic, yes, who had a decent, you know, 2022, but didn't do anything.
Is an ETR group chat favorite, but may not be a known commodity in other ways.
Speaking of Kellen Acosta, I think we can rule the Rapids out, because our buddy Tom is reporting that the Rapids are closing in on a deal for a new defensive midfielder. Nothing done yet, but advancing on a deal for Lamine Diak on a loan from Nantes.
23-year-old. Looks like it could be a good move. We'll see what happens there for the Rapids, who have been very, very busy all offseason. Mayan hits us up, says, could you please give me 3 reasons why the Whitecaps are winning MLS Cup? I'll start with one. Ryan Gaul just signed an extension in Vancouver today. Keeps him through 2027. And I believe it's the biggest contract in club history. So congratulations to Ryan Gaul. There's one reason, Doyle. Can you give me a reason? Doesn't need to be deep. Have fun with it. 2 sentences. Got one?
3 reasons as to...
I just need one. We've got one. We're trying to stack these. One game at a time, one reason at a time.
Pedro Vite makes the jump. Pedro Vite has been a tidy little midfield player who moves the game around. He hasn't been a game-breaking number 10. If you play a 3-5-2 with a game-breaking number 10 underneath Gold and Brian White, you can score a lot of goals, man.
Okay, so the third reason, Andres Cubas is a best-in-class MLS defensive midfielder, and you generally need that profile player to go win MLS Cup. So there's your reasons, Brian. We'll see if they come to pass. Reese hit us up and asked, which homegrown players do we anticipate taking the biggest step forward this season? Could be goals, defensive presence, passing numbers, role in the team, etc. He says he hopes Jack McGlynn take the next step and to level up physically. Maybe we'll come back to the which homegrown players. What's your vision for Jack McGlynn's season?
Yeah, leveling up physically would be the best thing for him, because that's all that stands between Jack McGlynn and having a significant career with, you know, a Champions League level team in Europe. I'm talking like a Club Bruges or an Ander. Like, the guy who Jack McGlynn reminds me of is Sasha. And Sasha came into the league as a chance creator who had to play outside of the middle. He had to play basically on the right wing for the first couple of years as he grew into his body physically. Philly have kind of fast-tracked McGlynn in that. Like, I didn't think he was ready for those minutes last year as a shuttler. If he can level up, if he could be that guy this year, he will help the Union win a lot of games, maybe win another trophy, and then he will make the same type of move that Sasha did to an Anderlecht, to a Club Bruges, and I think that would be just a great track for him.
About competition in that midfield, Alejandro Bedoya is still not signed. Jim Curtin said this recently, quote, "I think we did the right thing at the end of the day." At the end of the day, maybe being the key phrase there. Quote, "To have your captain, your leader, and the guy that will probably, along with Andre, the next guy to hang in those rafters next to Mr. Latou, we did the right thing." That's what I think, and I think we did the right thing, quote-unquote, eventually. So still waiting on Alejandro Bedoya. Evan hit us up, said, "Miami aside, the East is still set to be an absolute bloodbath this year. I could see any of the top five or six teams in any of the playoff seeds. What will differentiate Cincinnati, Orlando, Philly, Columbus, New England, and Atlanta as the season goes on?" Let's just rapid fire the weakness, the weak link for all of them. What's Cincy's weak link? We don't got to dig in too far. Just your first thought.
Wide play, potentially, if Barrial is sold.
How about a replacement for Vasquez? The presence, not just the goals.
Yep.
And then the variability of Bupenza.
Yep.
Yeah, could be. Or how about Orlando? The Lions.
It's chance creation. We've said it all summer or all winter long. The difference between Orlando being a 60-point team and a good team and a 70-point potential multiple trophy-winning team is having an elite chance creator. Maybe Ojeda's that guy. He was his final year in Argentina. I pulled his numbers. He was up in like the 98th percentile in expected assists and raw number chance creation and all that. And he played a lot of that time as a number 10. So we've said that they need to go out and get like a Reynoso or Carlos Gil level number 10. Okay, maybe they're thinking they're thinking they already have that. Now, Ojeda played last year mostly on the wing. And I think even in Argentina, he was mostly a winger. But that was true of Reynoso before he came to Minnesota. So maybe they think they have the guy. If they do, and then they need to add a center back as well, because I don't think Schlegel's a starter for a title-winning team.
You're Trojan horsing me to go get Ojeda on my Golden Boot team again. I know how this is going. Orlando, by the way, chasing a center back in Europe right now. We'll see if they can get that deal done. There's some back and forth as far as the fee goes on that one. How about Philadelphia? Is it just top-end talent being top-end talent?
I mean, would you take Gazdag, Carranza, and Ura as your three goal scorers? Would you take them over what Columbus has or what?
No.
Yeah, over Miami, over New England. You know, like, there's a chance that even NYCFC and the Red Bulls are ahead of these guys by the time the season kicks off, right?
Yep. How about the Crew? Is it sustainable?
Yeah. Right?
Because, like, Wilfred did amazing things in Montreal, but then he left, right? So we didn't really get to see that project continue
to build. Yeah.
I mean, their weakness they've sort of solved, which was dealing with direct balls, especially into the 18, and then closing out games, finding a way to be themselves, essentially, or the self that they wanted to be and showed for the vast majority of games to be that team for 95 minutes or whatever it took. It was late game situations and then direct balls that tested the center backs and Patrick Schulte.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. It's really more of like mentality. Can they be as up for it this year? And we've seen throughout the course of MLS history, but the course of sports history, it's hard to repeat unless you are Bayern Munich and you have three times as many resources as any other team in your league.
Impossible is an opinion.
Yeah.
So how about the Revs? It's a weakness. Vrioni in the center backs?
Yep. And like the Revs, for as many points as they've collected over the past few years, and even for Bruce Arena's reputation as a defensive coach, man, they were really bailed out by Matt Turner and then Georgi Petrovic. Like, those guys saved them a lot of points. They were not actually a super solid defensive team. I suspect more than anything else, that's what Caleb Porter will be working on over the next month.
Atlanta.
Defense. It's more structure with them than talent. Because I think that Purata and Gregerson, like, if you watch them play, like, they look like they should be very good MLS players. The same, obviously, Muyumba ended up covering a lot of that. I think Josh Cohen will end up being a big upgrade over last year's version of Brad Guzan. But it's still, like, even with all those upgrades and improvements, it's still, can this defense be good enough?
I think Parata's back on loan, back to Tigres, I want to say. So I think it's Abram.
Abram is who I meant.
Yeah,
sorry.
It's Abram, yeah. It's Gregerson, it's Williams. I mean, hey, like, no offense, that back line, that center back spot, other than Miles Robinson, has been rotational, let's say, for a couple of years now. This is a good one to end on from Zach Brown. I've been sitting on it for a while. MLS revisionist history. What single game result, if it was changed, would have the largest effect on the league and narratives therein? So I came up with some examples just to get your reaction to this, Doyle. First, you could go two games for Toronto. It could be one in 2016 when the Sounders got dominated, but one. It's the Steph Fry game, and Toronto just couldn't quite get it done in their first trip to Cup at home. But had they won that one, and then the next year they would have two straight Cups, which puts them in even more elevated territory on that project, or it would be the CCL final because the legacy of that particular team would sort of be evergreen forever, and maybe it could have staved off some of the ensuing chaos and just rank losing after that final. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the 2018 CCL final is the big one that popped into my head.
What about Pando Ramirez's extra time winner in 05? It was the first of three straight MLS Cups the Revs lose. Maybe if they win that one, their fate in the next two are different, and then they are one of the best. They're not the guys that couldn't quite get it done. They're like the dynastic team of the 2000s.
That certainly would be meaningful. If the Red Bulls had won in 2008, that would have been a significant change as well to the long-term fortunes of the club. But I think just for what it would have meant in that era and to the legacy of that team, probably 2018 CCL final or 2020 CCL final, in which LAFC actually had a lead over Tigres. It was in Orlando, right? It was in it was the bubble one, kind of. But that still would have been LAFC getting to the top of the Confederation, first of any American club to do it in the new format, and the only team since TFC to have done it. And obviously,
wins against, you would have had Tigres, America, and Chivas.
Right.
Checked off your list in one tournament.
But the fact that neither did, that just opened the doors to our friends in Seattle to get it done. And Anders is going to be angry at us for not mentioning that sooner.
It was a given, Anders. It was a given. All right, that's it for us. Thank you so much for listening. Big thanks to Diego Valeri for stopping by. Our coverage of the preseason rolls on. We're all pushing ahead till mid-February in the very first game on February 21st. Enjoy your time without Major League Soccer. It's coming to an end soon, I should say. Adios, everybody.
Thank you.